It's Wednesday, December 13, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a new streaming service from Tucker Carlson. We'll talk about what he's offering viewers and what this could mean for Fox News's bottom line. Alex Jones is back on X, formerly known as Twitter, what led Elon Musk to make an about-face on his promise this time last year to keep the conspiracy theorist off the social media platform, and
our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait,
yeah, that's the theme from the Big Bang Theory. We'll talk about why that song has meaning, to me at least, in 2023, and who knows about it. Isn't that a tease? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll talk about before our half hour is up today. We're going to start with a handful of journalists, each in need of our attention for work that they are doing here and abroad, all in the face of challenge. First, let's talk about CBS reporter Catherine Herridge, who is facing federal contempt charges for work she did back in 2017 for a previous employer. Kathy, tell us a little bit about the story that she was covering when she was working for Fox News and why the federal courts have such an interest.
Yeah, well, this was a case where she did reporting on a scientist who was at a Virginia university. And the question was, as this has come up frequently, was the scientist actually on spying for the Chinese government? The scientist was never charged, and the scientist is now suing the reporter. The scientist has been trying to find the source of Herridge's information, who was the one who told the reporter that this investigation was going on. And we've seen other cases like this before. The scientist has been unable, despite many depositions, to get a federal official to own up to this. So now she is going after the reporter and trying to get the reporter to give up sources. Today is a deadline for Catherine Herridge. A federal judge in Washington has ordered her to stand for a deposition, to be questioned about who her sources were. She is so far refusing. She's being hailed by press organizations for her courage. What's interesting about this case, and I've seen this once before with actually a former colleague of mine from USA Today, the judge, or the plaintiff here, the scientist who wants to find the source, is asking the judge to make Herridge personally responsible for the fines rather than have her news organization. She's currently working for CBS, but this happened when she was working for Fox. So rather than having either of the news organizations pick up the tab, she would be the one, which of course could bankrupt somebody. And this was tried once before in a federal case involving a reporter from USA Today. It eventually was thrown out, and eventually the source turned himself in. But this is a really scary thing, I think, for journalists so that even your news organization could not help you.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that last part that you put into this particular issue is I think the thing that's the most scary, because if, as you mentioned in the other case, the source came forward and said I was the one that leaked the information. If that doesn't happen in this instance, then she's gonna be held liable. That, I think, opens the floodgates to the possibility that this tactic will be used by others to go after individual journalists who, again, can't be shielded by their employer. But this is all the more reason to have a federal shield law.
Absolutely.
When you have issues like this, because again, it's one of those, okay, if I'm going to sue someone and I can't get the information that I need, then I'm going to basically go after the journalist. Again, now we have another First Amendment issue on top of all the other First Amendment issues that we've talked about throughout the year. But this one really carries a monetary weight to
it. Well,
it
could be ruinous.
It could be ruinous. Yes, absolutely. And that's I think that's the fear here.
Yeah, and I think, interestingly, the point you made, there is a federal shield law that's sitting in Congress right now. It's been introduced in both the House and the Senate. And interestingly, it has a very bipartisan group of supporters in both the House and the Senate, some very conservative Republicans, some very liberal Democrats. But I think it's going to be extremely hard to move this bill in this Congress, given all the political polarization over other issues. I mean, are they really going to set aside funding for Ukraine or Israel or the immigration fight to deal with this? And so that's the problem.
I mean, and I think what this does is, I mean, it's going to have a chilling effect on journalists.
Absolutely.
Especially when it comes to getting information from someone who wants to remain anonymous or someone who's leaking information. I mean, it's not just what the impact it's going to have on journalists. It's also the impact it's going to have on those who are within government who see wrongdoing happening, and their only way to get that out is to basically blow the whistle by giving that information to journalists.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the attorneys for the scientist here have borrowed this tactic. So we've seen it once before, trying to go after the reporter personally and cutting out the news organizations as a means of defense, or at least a financial means of defense. We'll see what happens. I mean, there's a decision due today from the district court judge, and based on what he's said so far, it doesn't look like it's going to go well for the reporter. But this can be appealed. So we'll see what happens. But you would hope that our court system would see this would be a horrendous blow, as you've said, Ernest, to working reporters.
Yeah. Okay, so another journalist, this one in, pardon me, in Russia, has been placed on the Kremlin's watch list. The Russian government has opened a case against Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen on charges of spreading false information about the Russian army. But it still seems unclear what they did to bring these charges or these concerns to the forefront.
Well, this just broke, and Masha Gessen is a very prominent Russian writer. He works for the New Yorker magazine. He's also an advocate for LGBTQ rights. And so I think, you know, it's sad because I've heard Gessen interviewed in the past about he lived in Russia for a long time, and then at a certain point when the government became very opposed to LGBTQ persons, he started to realize he had to move his family for his safety and theirs. But he's obviously loves his home country, and now he can't go back there. And again, this is, you know, we have Evan Gershkovich, we have the Radio Free Europe reporter who was hit with new charges this week. So Vladimir Putin is doing everything he can to silence anybody who might criticize him.
It's not all bad news for journalists in peril, though. You do have one uplifting story to
share with
us.
Yes, which we certainly need. Yes, yeah. Maria Ressa won another case this week in the Philippines, and she still has some charges pending against her, but this was a big victory. Again, this is kind of a page from the Dictator's Handbook. A lot of these strong men and Duterte tried this against Maria, the former president of the Philippines, saying that Rappler, her news organization, was foreign-owned because she gets some contributions from overseas. She won that case. So that is a really big deal, I think, not just for her, but for other publishers and editors of news outlets in other countries. But again, she's not completely out of the woods, but I think the fact every time she wins a victory, I think it's a sign of hope for the Philippines and also for other journalists worldwide.
Okay, so it was mere days that passed between Tucker Carlson's ouster from Fox News before his new show debuted on X. Well, Monday, he announced the launch on X of his new Tucker Carlson Network. The streaming service runs subscribers $9 a month or $72 a year and promises fresh interviews, documentaries, and, quote, access to Tucker's personal inbox to ask him anything that's on your mind. Mind you, this is TCN, not to be confused with CNN. But he has 11 million followers on X right now. It's a sizable audience that might be willing to fork over $72 a year.
Well, we'll see how many of those, you know, of those viewers are willing to do that. I do find it interesting that you have these personalities that when they are sort of dethroned from whatever institutional space that they're in, be it Fox, CNN, or MSNBC, they immediately jump out there and go straight to X, which used to be Twitter, create an echo chamber for themselves. And then when they get to a certain number of people who are following them, all of a sudden they jump out and say, well, I'm going to branch out and have my own this or my own that, and I'm going to name it after myself. And I'm just not seeing it go any further than the same number of people they had when they jumped out there on X or Twitter.
Well, and I think how many of them are going to convert to paying customers?
Right. And especially in the streaming service. Everybody's trying to determine how many streams.
Because everybody needs one more stream.
Right. Yeah.
The other thing is it shows you he's not getting advertisers. I mean, people aren't advertising against him. And that's when you start to go for paying subscribers, when certainly that's what we do in the news business, right? And so welcome to our world, Tucker, and see how that goes for you.
One of the things about this that's kind of notable is how we are seeing Fox News alumni not so quietly attempting to chip away at the network's business model. A decade ago, Glenn Beck launched The Blaze, Ben Shapiro with The Daily Wire. Now we see Greta Van Susteren and Eric Bolling on Newsmax. All of these competitors are working to beat Fox at its own game. Is it working?
Well, I mean, I think what you have is that as long as they're on a low cost channel, be it something put up by X or someone else, it's fine because people aren't really having to invest in it. And like it goes back to your advertising scenario that you were just talking about, Kathy. When they start doing what Tucker Carlson is trying to do, they run into problems. Same thing with Glenn Beck. He tried to jump out there and do the same thing, and it just didn't fly. And I think that's where they sort of they overreach. I mean, it took Fox a long time to get to where it is now. They're trying to sort of jumpstart that in a matter of months or years, and what you're seeing is some epic failures.
Well, and the other thing is Fox owns its platform.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So when people advertise on Fox, Fox gets the money.
Right.
When people advertise, if they advertise, against Tucker or Glenn Beck or whomever, X gets the money.
Right.
Elon Musk gets the money, not them. So that's the fallacy, I think. People, and certainly we in the news business know this. You go on these platforms, but you can't monetize. So good luck with that.
I mean, the other thing too is that, you know, Fox is bankrolled by Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an international brand. I mean, you know,
Fox is just one piece of a
global conglomerate.
Yeah.
And so they don't have that. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically all they have is, you know, some studio that they set up in a freaking basement. and now all of a sudden,
or I think with Tucker, it's his barn, right?
Yeah, I was going to say,
have you been watching Tucker's program to see what it is? You know, that's basically what we're talking about here. It's like, you know, I have this massive empire, you know, and people are flocking to me. And it's like, no, that's not what's happening here.
Okay, so just when you thought things couldn't get any more extreme at Elon Musk's X, again, we'll say it because it's AP style, formerly known as Twitter, he decides via a user vote to welcome conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and InfoWars back onto the platform. According to reporting in the New York Post, it was actually Tucker Carlson who persuaded Musk to reinstate Jones, saying that if Musk is truly the absolutist that he claims he is about free speech, he should bring back Alex Jones.
Because Tucker wanted somebody who was a crazier demagogue than him.
we'll see there. But Musk has always said that the reversal, that bringing Jones back, would require a process. And I guess that process was carried out this weekend when 70% of 2 million X users replied to a poll that Musk launched asking simply, reinstate Alex Jones on this platform. Now, Piers Morgan is among those calling out the hypocrisy of this move, pointing out that Musk's own words from a year ago said that Musk has no mercy for anyone who would use the deaths of children for gain, politics, or fame. Here we are. What could have been the motivation here if not politics, fame, or money?
Let's all say it together. Money.
Okay, so this wasn't politics. Yeah. This wasn't, okay.
No, this money was all about money. I mean, it goes back to what you just said. I mean, they don't have the advertisers. Yeah. I mean, Elon Musk has lost the majority of his advertisers because of the actions that he's taken. And he needs to have some sort of revenue coming in. And if you bring in Alex Jones, you're going to bring in the revenue that he brings in. Yes, you're going to bring in the crazy, but then again, you know, ever since he bought Twitter, which is now X, it's been a crazy show.
Well yeah. And to underscore your point, any coincidence that this came a week or two after Musk announced Twitter might be going bankrupt, Twitter now X might be going bankrupt. So he's in a, you know, Twitter is in some serious financial trouble because Musk has lost a lot of advertisers. And so just when you're desperate, you go to the bottom of the well, I guess.
Yeah.
This has been one of those situations as well where there is now, what, the third or the fourth wave of people saying, forget it, I'm out of here, right? This is one step too far. And
until the next step is taken.
Right. That's right. The whole thing. And so there has been advice out there. I saw it most recently from Guy Kawasaki saying, you don't want to be on that platform? Fine, don't use it. Don't give up your handle. Because what happens if somebody else comes back in and it ends up being, it goes back to what we knew it to be 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago? You've given up your little space there and opened the door for somebody else to take your handle. That if you want to go back into that space, you're forfeiting your ability to do so as you once did.
I mean, I understand that. And there's some validity to that. But I just don't think it's going to go back. It's going to take someone who has the resources that Musk has to come and basically buy it from him and then spend a lot of time and a lot of effort trying to rebrand that to maybe not, definitely not to what Musk was doing, but to try to rebrand that to something that it used to be.
Yeah.
That's a lot of effort and
a lot of
time and a lot of
trust and
money.
Goodwill has been squandered.
Yeah.
I mean, because who's going to trust a new owner? Well, maybe the new sheriff is a white hat, but how long will the new sheriff own it?
Right.
And so I think this is where, you know, we've talked about this before, but the platforms are privately owned platforms, and you are at the mercy of the owners, and sometimes owners change.
So our next topic is something that we had hoped to talk about last week, but because of breaking news, the death of Norman Lear last Wednesday morning, we didn't get to it in our show. And so we wanted to bring it back and talk about it today. It's about Dr. Joan Donovan, and she is or was professor at Harvard University, and she is asking for an independent review of her ouster from that university, where she had worked as a scholar studying propaganda and the spread of disinformation. She says that donor influence led to her firing after she started to analyze a series of documents pointing to, quote, significant public harm caused by Facebook parent company Meta. The donor, Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan. These files that we're talking about, they're the Facebook files, ultimately talked about by whistleblower Francis Hahn and Hagen, thank you, and provided to Congress, also to certain news organizations, also in 2021, about the same time as this gift was made to Harvard.
Yeah, this is such an interesting story. And, you know, it's funny. I taught this in one of my classes. Joan Donovan wrote an interesting book that was published, I think, about a year ago called Meme Wars. And she and two other researchers, also her colleagues at Harvard, did all of this work looking at the way social media platforms, particularly Reddit, was used by far-right groups to organize for January 6th, to kind of lay the groundwork, to build a movement, and then to ultimately do the nitty-gritty organizing for the attack on the Capitol. And she was dismissed, and I remember pointing this out to some of my students. Do you think there's any coincidence that this $500 million gift was given from Zuckerberg's foundation to Harvard, and here she is bringing a lawsuit, so she made the connection too. This, I think, is really interesting because there's so much money in the social media world. And there was another example of this a couple of years ago at an organization called the New America Foundation in Washington, which is a highly respected think tank that is heavily funded by one of the Google founders, or the former Google CEO, Eric Schmidt. And one of the researchers there criticized Google and was quickly axed. So I think this is a really, you know, there's all kinds of ways that money influences politics, but one of the hidden ways is philanthropic contributions to think tanks, universities, and then the donors using that to influence what the administrators do. And it isn't as visible mm-hmm. as campaign contributions or lobbying expenditures, but I think it's something we really need to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, when I remember the book coming out, and I remember reading about her leaving the Kennedy School and, you know, basically saying, well, she wasn't faculty, she's staff. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, you've treated her as a faculty member. And if you're going to limit her academic freedom, if she's out there promoting and talking about these issues that have been funded by donors and the Kennedy School, but then when you run into an issue where you have a mega donor like Mark Zuckerberg, who is basically, you know, upset about the way this mm-hmm. is playing out and how his company is being, you know, as he would say, or some of his people would say, targeted mm-hmm. by this research, then all of a sudden, she's not a faculty member. Her academic freedom that she's basically been given is taken away from her, and then she's unceremoniously asked to leave. There's serious problems here because it's going to have an impact on the research you're doing. You wouldn't allow that in the case of medical, right?
Right.
But you're allowing it as it relates right. to misinformation and disinformation on social media platforms that's used by millions around the world.
Yeah. That was ultimately created in a dorm at that university.
Right. Exactly. And the other interesting thing that you raise, Ernest, that I think, you know, it struck me thinking about this case, is we often hear and talk about public universities being under political pressure right. from politicians, state legislators, but private universities with big fat endowments have a different kind of political pressure to deal with when you see these big donors coming in and saying, oh, I don't like what that professor is looking into. I wish that professor would stop turning over these rocks that are
right.
showing the little worms
don't,
in my
then
business.
My yeah. donations may dwindle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's kind of depressing to see institutions like Harvard that have really large endowments knuckling under to that kind of pressure.
Right.
Okay. You heard it at the top of the show, the theme from The Big Bang Theory. If you've made it this far with us, it's time now for the payoff. What does that have to do with anything that we're talking about? Well, according to my Spotify Wrapped, I listened to that song 38 times, and Bare Naked Ladies, that Canadian group that was super hot in the 90s, was my top artist, followed by Fleetwood Mac, Jimmy Buffett, Simon and Garfunkel, and Paul Simon doing solo work. So clearly, I am a child of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Spotify Wrapped has turned into a social media pride point for people of many generations as they're sharing these data dumps from the music music streaming service to Facebook and Instagram, because they are produced to be shared in very friendly sharing formats, complete with the songs themselves attached. What's kind of cool, or not, and that's the part I want to talk about, is how this concept has now become, I don't know, fodder for the copycats, right? The Washington Post now has its, I believe it's called the newsprint feature that will sum up. Okay, so I'm going to say, because, you know, Travis McMillan, our director, and I, we were trying to figure out, Ernest, if you were on Spotify, and we both probably figured not. But no, you're looking at me like, you're right. But we are figuring, you've seen your Washington Post Wrapped.
I have not seen it. I just found it earlier this week, and I was like, "Oh, that may be something to do over the break, just to see what because I do read the Washington Post, and I'm on the website on a daily basis, and so it'd be interesting to see what it comes up with in this feature.
Shock of all shocks, I will tell you, mine showed that I read a lot of media blogs on the Washington Post, and that Eric Wemple, one of their media bloggers, and it was kind of cool because it showed up at the end with like a video of him talking to me, not me personally, but like talking to the readers who were his loyal audience. I even got one of these from Wendy's, right? Like apparently I ordered burgers through the app more than any other food. But I think one of the things, like, as fun as stuff like this might be, it's also a really stark reminder of the depths to the data that we're giving up about ourselves.
Absolutely. I'm going to out curmudgeon Ernest on this one because, no, I think this is the thing. And, you know, it is a reminder. And it reminds me of, I'm blanking, I'm going to get it wrong, but remember there was like a game on Facebook, something with a farm, the farm.
Farmville.
Thank you.
Yes, Farmville. I, for the record, never played Farmville.
Okay, me either, but I know a lot of people who did.
Yeah.
But the whole idea, and it's the same thing with all these quizzes, people, they're serving this information up because they want you to click on it. They want to get more data on you. And that data is being used not only to serve up advertisements, but to affect your news feed. And this is the thing that I think is really important for readers, viewers, and listeners to understand, that it's not just the advertisements you see, it's the news you see. And that is where the filter
bubble. It's almost everything you see
exactly.
to a certain extent.
Yes,
you
know, and algorithms are creating even tighter, more hermetically sealed filter bubbles. And I think unless we understand that and figure out ways to get out of it, we're going to end up being a much more polarized society.
And that's the scary thing. I mean, you know, people are, I remember back during COVID, people were talking about tracking and all of this thing. I mean, that is the tracking. They are tracking your every
movement. Your employer
movement
doesn't need to track you because your device is doing it for them.
Your device is doing it for them.
And your credit cards. And
exactly. Every time you go into Google or you go into Facebook or Instagram or whatever, they are gathering information about you, and they're tracking what you're doing, what you're ordering, how you live your life.
Right, and they create a marketing profile. Which our folks at Stratcom know all about, but it is a marketing profile, but that profile is being used not just to market, but to keep you on site.
Absolutely.
How do people keep you on site? They give you stories
they're
comfortable with.
Yep.
Exactly.
More of what you want.
Exactly.
Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I would like to thank you for spending your last half hour with us. You can read more about all of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Maybe we'll show up in somebody's Wrapped. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is at @viewsonkbia. We have a bit of a programming note for you. The three of us are going to be taking some time off. We will be back with you on January 17th, but I do urge you to tune in on December 27th and January 3rd for a special edition of our program produced and hosted by six students from the University of Missouri's Honors College. Thanks to Travis McMillan for directing the show, to Kia Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pulcher for our theme music, and Nate Brown, our social media manager.